Welcome to the Sexual Mindfulness Project podcast, where we talk about creating an intentional relationship and how to find joy in slowing down, letting go of judgment, and connecting more deeply with your partner.
Okay. Well, Dean, we are so happy to have you here. We have Dr. Dean Busby with us. We're going to talk about a couple of topics today, but first would like to just have you tell us a little bit about yourself, anything you would like, how you met your wife, why you study sex, maybe where you studied, how you came to be on this path, and maybe even something personal, like what you like to do in your free time.
Okay. So I grew up in a little town in Southern California. California is a farming community, was a member of the Church of Jesus Christ, and that was sort of a central organizing thing in our family. But farming and land and animals and all that kind of stuff was, and family was, were super important to us. But my father was this math genius kind of guy, and Lockheed had found him and developed him into an engineer without schooling. He never had a degree. And so that shifted our family from poor dirt farmers to moving into a little more professional roles. And in his love for school and learning and all of that, and my mother had that as well, was something I think they infected us with. And so most of us as kids were really good students, strong students, you know, and not pressure. It was no pressure. It's just like, this is what we do as a family.
How old were you when that transition took place between farming and...
By the time I came around, because I was seventh out of eight kids, he was well into the engineering life. And we had a gentleman farm all my life. So by then it was a hobby, not a central sort of how we're going to survive. And so then, like the rest of my siblings, you know, school was a natural, enjoyable experience for me, studying and learning. And I saw it because neither of my parents had a degree. In fact, my mom didn't graduate from high school until she was in her 50s because she married young.
Interesting. How old was she when she married?
She was 16.
And how old was your dad?
He was 17 and a half.
Oh, so they were young kids.
And like I say, in central Arizona, and they got married and went off, tried to scratch out a living. And fortunately for my father, he had this capacity that was recognized. Yeah. But as a result, this passion for learning, and they're always talking about it as an opportunity missed for them, that if we pick that up in it sort of implicitly, and we all worked hard at school and loved school. And, you know, I never thought a second about whether I would go to college. It was just sort of, I'm going to college and of course. And what to study was sort of a little bit more of a discovery. I had some of my father's math, not anywhere near as brilliant as him, but, you know, some tendencies. And so initially was thinking of programming or other science kind of fields. But I got interested, super interested in people and psychology. And I just found, like, if I was going to study something scientifically, nothing was more complex than weird people. They're just so difficult to figure out. And, like, why do we do what we do? It's all this stuff about motivation.
Do you feel like you like people? Are you an extrovert?
I'm an introvert.
Okay.
Yeah. And so it's been a struggle to stay engaged in what my profession demands of me, except the teaching piece became sort of over time more natural. But at first it was very hard. It's exhausting. I'm still more tired after teaching my extrovert colleagues. You know, they just live off of that. I'm like exhausted. But so still have that introverted issue. But studying people and then teaching about people and all has sort of helped me be a little more extroverted in terms of the demands. But still, you give me my preference in terms of, you ask about hobbies and things like that. I mean, I would be just as happy hiking alone in the mountains or working with wood or doing some family history or something or research and not interacting with people. I mean, the COVID has been like a natural fit for me. I mean,
loved it.
Yeah. I mean, some people are just like, I'm dying, and I'm pretty happy in terms of the less intense demanding meetings and things like that. It's sort of more of a natural fit for me. A scholar, I like to study. I like to learn, and I like to understand and try to understand. So I got into the psychology piece, and then pretty soon as an undergraduate, I realized that psychology was too much about dysfunction and internal stuff, like cognitive, mental issues.
Yeah.
Relational was where everything got really complicated. Now it's two people trying to get along and figure things out. And that really intrigued me. Like, how does that work? And how can we understand how that works? I naturally sort of moved over. I got an undergraduate degree in psychology. And at the University of Utah, my wife was teaching teaching up there. And we met on our missions of all places down in South America, Chile, and got back and started dating. And we finished at the same time. And so it was sort of a natural. I mean, I actually asked her on the plane ride home, you want to get going? And she was,
that was pretty bold for an introvert.
My mission president pushed me on that. You have to think about dating her there, Sister Hamilton.
And as a matter of fact, I'll ask on the way home.
Yeah, so we did. And so then I came up for conference a few weeks later and we started dating. And I lived in California. She was in Utah. And it rolled pretty well. And we got married 8 months later. There you have it.
It's a good story.
You know, I had met her and I was going to, so that's why I went to school up at Universidad. They had an excellent psychology program. It was better than the one here at the time. And was planning to go into clinical psychology and actually got admitted to clinical psych graduate programs. But I applied to family therapy at the same time. And it was just kept, you know, resonating really strong. I want to study relationships. It's not about this intra-psychic stuff. So I moved over to studying relationships and got a PhD from BYU in family therapy. And then went out and taught in a family therapy program for many years. Ended up coming back and now I'm in family studies. So it's even a better fit for me, the study of families and relationships than the therapy stuff. Because I did not enjoy therapy, but I enjoyed the study and the discussion and the education about families more than the therapy. When an opportunity came to come back here in a family studies position, I jumped at it.
Do you find that a lot of your research is for therapists or is it a little broader than that?
I would say about a third of my research still lands in some of the therapy journals and I give it an applied sense. I use that background. And the other two thirds is more of a, you know, family life education basic family scholar kind of stuff. In terms of what kinds of relationships to study, pretty soon I realized that it wasn't the parent-child relationships that were super interesting to me. I mean, while I was having young children, I certainly studied more of that. But the whole time through, I was pretty interested in the couple dynamic relationship, that sort of how do couples work, how do they not work, and came to sexuality in the last third of my career. The first 20 years I studied a little bit of sexuality. You can't not study sexuality and study couples, but it wasn't the primary emphasis and topic. When I came to BYU 15 years ago now, I realized that more and more that sexuality was this unique area where particular challenges emerge, especially for highly religious people, I think. And it is actually what I think uniquely defines marriage. And so everything else you can do in marriage, just about, except for have children, is not unique to marriage. They're the same as other relationships you have. But as you dig in, this sexual dynamic and energy and how to manage this area of life is what I think defines marriage as compared to other relationships. So I thought, I've got a gap. And then I was this noise as I started teaching at BYU with all these struggles around, you know, the students, when they would come and talk, they would most generally, if they were going to lay something difficult out on the table, it had something to do with managing sexuality. And so I thought I need to jump into this and I want to finish my career on that topic. It was so fun and interesting initially that I knew it was going to be enough energy there to carry out me through the rest of my career. The other thing is it's just so wide open compared to other, it's strange because you think, again, all these people studying marriage would put more effort into understanding sexuality, but it's still relatively sparse, even in our journal. It leaves me lots of avenues to sort of have room to mess around and learn new things.
One thing that's interesting about your research is that you really combine sex with the relationship. You're not studying each of those topics separately.
Yeah.
You're talking about sex embedded in a committed relationship and how that really functions to create more energy within the relationship.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because I came from this background of having studied for almost 20 years marriage, it just made sense to apply it in that way and take the strengths I had and think about sexuality in marriage. I had a choice point early on in sexuality to study sexuality generally. But I kept saying, no, that doesn't interest me. Like, you know, how adolescents deal with their sexual beginnings and all. Yeah, that's not the thing. And even sexuality in couple relationships, but not marriage, that doesn't do it for me either. I want to understand the sustaining of sexuality across years. That's what felt to me like the biggest gap in all the research, strangely, is that longitudinal. How do you keep that energy moving in good directions? How do you keep that part of a relationship working? It seemed like the biggest gap to me.
Yeah. I mean, truthfully, I think it's maybe more complex than other sexual relationships that are being studied out there, because, you know, where you're having multiple partners, it's kind of just about the mechanics there. And, but when it's embedded in this committed long-term relationship, it's about how do we keep the spark alive and how do we navigate our past families and habits and traditions and a really powerful relationship.
Yeah. And with aging and the changes in the body, it creates a whole nother layer of complexity. I'm attracted to complex things and always have been. And I think that's that mathematical piece, that sort of deeper pattern. Sexuality feels so complicated to me. I mean, I don't want anybody listening to this think that it's impossible, but it's just so nuanced and so many different interesting ways to meet.
Well, that's what makes it so interesting for everybody. I mean, even if you are in a long-term committed relationship, it can always be interesting and changing. So one thing that we have talked about, we both teach the Healthy Sexuality and Marriage course. And one thing that we've talked about is the issue of autonomy and how that fits within sexuality, within a sexual relationship. So why do you think that autonomy is so important to healthy sexuality?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And in some ways, I think the self-determination theory has informed a lot of my work over the years, and it's one of the three core needs. In some ways, when I think about my own work, it's the one I've neglected the most, autonomy. It's almost like I think of it as this condition that has to exist before you can meet the need of relatedness and competence they talk about, or belonging and becoming, like we write about. And so I sort of had thought about that as almost like it's given. If you don't have autonomy, nothing else is going to work. But I think I shortchanged. I thought about coming and talking more about it, and that it's not as automatic. It's certainly a struggle, autonomy, and it's so fundamentally important in terms of sexuality that I think it needs more attention. I need to give it more attention.
Let me interrupt you for just a second. Would you just give like a little working definition of what you think autonomy is, just for our listeners, so that they could understand what we're talking about when we say autonomy?
I think autonomy is about being able to express yourself or behave in ways that you feel are your choice.
Okay.
You're able to be the one that makes those choices.
That's good.
And it's not independence. This is where a lot of people get confused with this word. It's not about being independent. That's a totally different construct, and it's really not particularly relevant to this issue of autonomy. You can be an independent person, minded person, in a context of low autonomy and high autonomy, and you can be a dependent person in a context of low or high autonomy.
Can you give an example of that maybe?
Yeah. So think about a person in Afghanistan. I was just listening this morning on the radio, and this person in Afghanistan with the new Taliban, if she was a woman, she can't go outside anymore. She felt totally restricted, low autonomy. She can't make a lot of choices she was making before, very oppressive. But she chose to go out and protest, and I thought probably risk her life. Mm-hmm. So she made a really autonomous choice because it's in her. She feels the importance of it and is willing to act on that in a low autonomy environment. But another person with a lower sense of the importance of autonomy and it doesn't resonate with them is never going to take that kind of, not that everybody should, but is never going to take that kind of a risk. And so they could be low autonomy in a low autonomy environment, and there's never going to be a process.
You could live in America and still not speak up for what you deeply held beliefs you have, or something that's kind of urging you to say something, and you don't because you have low autonomy.
Yeah. And we talk about autonomy in our writing as it's related to passion. And I like that because I think it has to do with strong feelings and strong interests. And when you're able to act on those feelings and interests autonomously, as you would like, as your choice directs, then I think everything works so much better than if you're doing it because you're supposed to, or because you have to, or because somebody else
wants. Or you're tamping down feelings you have, you'd like to express, but you don't, because maybe that's not what a proper wife does.
Right, exactly. So low autonomy. So we can internalize this concept of autonomy inside of ourselves. And I think that's the ideal, as we try to raise children, especially in the sexuality area, to feel in control of their sexuality, but not having this low autonomy environment, so that they can express any of their sexuality because it's wrong or because they're shamed about it or whatever. They feel they can express it and they have permission to express it and they have a desire to express it. But it doesn't mean, some people misinterpret high autonomy as being free for all too. That's not what it means either.
Right.
You understand autonomy, that you're interfering with the autonomy of another person, especially with sexuality. It's a relational dynamic. And so if your spouse wants to do something different than you or not do what you want to do, and you begin to try to negotiate those differences, both people have to feel like they have autonomy. And that isn't always easy to find.
Yeah.
It's a challenge.
Yeah. And in fact, it's when you're both expressing your autonomy, especially if both people have high autonomy, that probably the couple's going to experience a lot of growth. Mm-hmm. As they try and negotiate that, like you're saying.
Yeah.
Right? Talk about gender differences that you might notice from research or from your own counseling or in whatever circumstance. But what are gender differences that we see in autonomy?
Well, that question makes me want to know what the data says about that. I would guess, based upon some of the stuff we've done with sexual passion, that women in general are more likely to feel less autonomous in terms of sexuality, and men are more likely to feel more autonomous. But I think there's large numbers of people who feel like there's a struggle with autonomy. And I think it's not so much always about the dynamics in a particular relationship as it is the way we think about sexuality. So if my sexuality is burdened with high anxiety because of a variety of attitudes I was taught with or experiences, and I just feel anxious and uncomfortable with sexuality, that interferes with my autonomy. I think we make women ashamed more of their sexuality than we do men. And so that would mean that they should have, in general, lower levels of feeling that they can make autonomous choices. There's so many shoulds and have tos and can'ts and such that it's hard to figure out what they want and what they need. And then if you don't know those things, how can you make a choice? So I would think that would be what the data suggests. And we see higher levels of inhibition, sexual passion style is inhibited in women than men. And that generally speaks to lower levels of autonomy. Mm-hmm. And we see higher levels of obsessive passion in men. Well, that doesn't mean necessarily high autonomy, because you can obsess about something from a non-autonomous place because you just sort of got distorted views about what matters in life. But I think it does represent this idea that men have a little more freedom to be sexual than women, and a little more freedom to be sexual in destructive ways, I think, than women. Mm-hmm. We overlook
possibly
that.
Yeah.
So I think, again, that there's some dynamics there. The other thing is, I think we teach women, this is where autonomy should be higher in women, I think we teach women more effectively how to be relationally minded. And while that could seem like it would interfere with autonomy, I think if you understand relationships better, you know how to negotiate them and be in them in healthy ways, I think you have more choices to negotiate decisions around sexuality with autonomy, even though it may seem like it's for the good of your partner. And so I'll give you an example. We have the general pattern we know where one person has more sexual interest than the other in a relationship. If I understand the importance of relationships and I'm relationally oriented, I can make a decision to be sexual with a partner when I don't necessarily feel like it. But because I'm thinking of the overall good of the relationship, I don't feel like it's forced. I don't feel like I have to. I feel like I want to, but for different reasons, because I, again, have a relational view of the world. Now, it could be that I was taught about relationships in a guilt-inducing way, right. And so then it's less autonomy.
Right.
But I think if you have the skill set to be strongly relationally oriented, you know how to negotiate relationships better, you have some choices that you could make that would make even a decision about wanting to be sexual at a certain time and place when you don't feel like it as much as more autonomous choice than my spouse wants to be sexual and I feel guilty and mm-hmm. I'm going to be sexual. That's not an autonomous choice.
Right. I'll go along with it, but I'll kind of resent it. Yeah.
But I could say, yeah, I want to be sexual because I know that she wants to be and that I'm doing this willingly, even though the initial energy is not there. And because I love her and I care about my relationship, I can make that choice autonomously. And guess what happens? Well, the energy comes during the process. And even though the desire wasn't as strong.
And inevitably, either partner is going to feel that. But if that attitude that you just described is present, that's going to create some really strong feelings of sacrifice and love for each other.
Yeah.
We meet each other's needs.
Well, and of course, how your partner deals with differences can make it harder for you to feel like you can make it. So if my partner yes. is prone to pouting or cajoling or coercing, mm-hmm. coerciveness, then I feel like it's miserable for me either way.
Yeah.
And I don't win either way.
Yeah.
To me, that's a non-relational way of thinking. If I have to force people to do what I want by making them miserable, that's not a relational right. orientation. Right. That's a selfish orientation.
This is what makes it so complex.
Right, right. That autonomy comes in. And the people in your near environment have a lot to say about how autonomous we feel, I think, because of the way they approach differences. Mm-hmm. It's all about that.
Interesting. So, I mean, it sounds like you would say that, yes, probably women feel less autonomy generally, but both men and women struggle yeah. with this idea of really being autonomous. So if you were going to give some suggestions, if I'm a person who's not feeling high autonomy in my life, mm-hmm. what sorts of things could I do to start creating more autonomy and how I think?
Are we talking about big picture general autonomy, not sexuality?
Well, why don't you give a little of both? Because okay. don't you think they blend
yeah,
together?
I do. I do. Okay. So this to me is where the research that we do on passion is so important. What this research says to us is if people don't have the opportunities in their life to do things they feel strongly about and they can work at them, sustain that effort over time, they're not going to be happy. So without passion, what is life? You know, without mm-hmm. any passion yeah. in life. And so usually if a person feels low autonomy, they aren't pursuing the passions that they want to pursue in their life. So the first step is finding a way to chip away at that. As I'm talking to you, I remember a young mother I worked with once who she had 7 kids mm-hmm. and they were all young at the time. And she used to be an artist and she was miserable. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was not as much of what I would call a natural mother. It was sort of a lot of hard work and she
yeah.
did a nice job, but it was just not her thing, right?
Yeah.
And so not her natural passion. And so she had put everything she had into this, but let go of her art.
Yeah.
And so it took me so long to help her give herself permission to start painting again. And it was so bewildering to me because like her husband wasn't saying, you can't do that. You don't have any time. He was very supportive. He wanted yeah. her to be happy. He could tell she was miserable. I think the kids would have said, yeah, mom, paint too.
Please.
Right? You know, but of course, then they want their time, you know,
yeah.
so they didn't. And so it was just that she had the interpretation was if I do this thing of art, it's selfish mm-hmm. when I have all these needs
yeah.
rather than this is going to generate more energy in me and give me some more autonomy and more
yeah.
sense of a passion in life. And then I'll be able to engage better with my family. It took so long to get that turned
yeah.
around. In her-
that makes sense to me though, because I grew up with some scripts in my mind mm-hmm. that I had to stick to this script. And so I think it's hard for us to
yeah.
give ourselves permission to yeah. step outside of that.
Well, when you live in a culture that says relationships are all that matter,
yeah,
then anything that's not about being in a relationship right at that moment feels selfish. But we also live in a culture, if we think right, it says, I gave you these talents, and if you don't develop them, that's a tragedy.
Yeah.
And all talents could enrich the world in and outside of the family, but we don't balance those very well. We tend to just go all in and then give up one and the other. So anyway, I think the first step is remembering what some of your passions and interests are and finding a way to chip away at a few of them mm-hmm. and engage in them a little bit. And then you begin to feel a little more alive. And then I think it does generalize over into other parts of your life where you can then make some decisions. So let's say I'm this woman and I'm starting to paint and I'm starting to feel really good about it.
Mm-hmm.
And now somebody's asking me to do something they really should do for themselves. No, you clean your room. I'm not
right.
going to clean your room anymore. Right?
Right.
And so I give myself space and more autonomy to say, this should be something you're doing, not I'm doing for you, because I want to get to painting.
Yeah.
You know,
great.
And so I think it can generalize in that way. Mm-hmm. Now, sexuality, it can be complex in the terms of what the patterns are that you've developed over time in marriage. So let's say you've been in a marriage 10 years or so or more, and the pattern doesn't feel like it's mostly your doing what a partner wants to do. So low autonomy, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be kind of hard to renegotiate that because it may be perfectly fine for the partner at that point. I mean, they may be getting their way and they don't know. You're not overt about it. You're being nice.
They haven't seen the suffering they're causing the other partner.
And so like, you're going to stir up this apple cart here and it's going to tip over. And so you have to begin to express the things that you feel you need to be different, and don't bury somebody with it all. And because they've been in this thing that's felt great for 10 years and you're not. So if that's a situation, then I think in a more slow way, you start picking at certain parts of it, whether that's frequency, types of behaviors you're doing, the environment around sexuality, that kind of stuff. I think whatever part of the sexuality feels the most constrictive to you, the most autonomy sapping.
That's going to be hard though for a woman. Let's assume it's a woman, right? Who has low autonomy. It's going to be tough for a woman to start speaking up about something that maybe she has felt she shouldn't even have an opinion on, right? Maybe those are the sorts of scripts that she's bought into. And so how would you encourage her to speak up and start talking about some of her needs or some of the things maybe that she just doesn't like, but maybe let's start with the positive things, right? Maybe some things that could be met by that relationship.
So I would think one of the keys is to figure out why she, if it's a she or he, hasn't spoken up in a long time.
Yeah.
Like, why have you kept silent about it? And usually when people keep silent about something, it's because they're anxious about it. They feel like they shouldn't have that opinion. They shouldn't want that thing or not want that thing.
Yeah.
Or they're doing it out of love. They want their partner to enjoy things and they don't want to interfere. So it's sort of a self-sacrificing kind of thing. And depending on, so take those two, they go in really different directions, don't they? One is if it's for self-sacrifice, and then it's actually a little bit easier to get a person to start speaking up, because you could say, well, what you're really doing is you're saying, I don't want to make my partner upset because I want them to be happy. But you think they would be more or less happy if you're fully in this thing?
Yeah. If you're enjoying it as well.
Yeah. Of course they're going to say, Well, yeah. And do you think they probably are? And the thing is, if you're working with them together, they'll say, yeah, I know she hasn't been that happy about it. I haven't known how to talk about it, but whatever. And so they, of course, so that's easy. This one over here, where you're not speaking up because you don't feel like maybe you should have those feelings,
right?
Like it's not right or appropriate or whatever to have those desires, or you were taught that a man or a woman shouldn't want this. And then those take a little bit more time to sort of unravel. You have to begin to ask yourself additional questions about, what is it about this that you feel is wrong? Is it just your mother's voice or your dad's voice or, you know, the bishop's voice or somebody's voice you've got in your head? Is it real? Was there trauma? What are the sources of this? And then sometimes it's relatively easy to figure out, well, that's not what I need to be thinking. And other times it's harder because you had bad experiences or something and you have to work through that. And so some of that kind of stuff with trauma, especially, I think would require a little more intense work, maybe some therapy, depending. Whereas, you know, if it's the way you were brought up, I think you can begin to rethink things sometimes. And really the challenging thing, but the great thing about autonomy, assuming again, you're not in a relationship where your spouse is coercive.
Yeah.
I think the great thing about it is the solution is just start experimenting with it. Just start saying, take those little risks. And as you do that and you realize it's not going to end our relationship and I'm not going to be seen, it's freeing. It really is freeing. And then you feel like you can make more risk and both of you will enjoy that extra energy and openness about things at some point. It may be a little bit difficult at the beginning.
Yeah. And probably absent trauma. People have little voices in their head in their sexual relationship that are saying, this could be better if I spoke up or if I said what my desire was or, you know, whatever it is. And so I think what you're saying is just take that risk and start speaking up and talking about it.
And that brings up sort of the third reason that we're not autonomous. We just get lazy sometimes, right? Because, you know, sexuality is a behavior that gets into a routine pretty quickly. And so the routine is what it is, and we do what we do, and we just don't say anything. It's so much more lazy just to let it go, right?
Interesting.
Just do what you do, right? And so
rock the boat.
Yeah, exactly. And so then we actually lose autonomy in overly routine behaviors because we don't choose them anymore. We just do them, right? And so we're not being forced, but it's also not something we're like consciously thinking about anymore. it's just a habit. And so that's where you have to sort of realize, yeah, we do this the same way every time. Yeah, there's some things about it that could really be better, I think. Why haven't I said anything? Well, I just guess I just want to have it.
Right.
So it's not always about bad upbringing or trauma or something else. It's just that behavioral habits.
Well, of course, I have to insert mindfulness here, because I think that's really maybe the antidote to this laziness, is that we could just be a little more mindful. And maybe mindful doesn't motivate us to think of this different, but maybe the word curiosity does. Mm-hmm. Why don't we be a little curious about why do we always get into this same pattern of interacting with each other?
I love that word in mindfulness. I think that it is such a positive take, and it has so much more positive energy than curiosity. You know, why do we still do this the same way? What happens to me when we start that I just stop thinking? What could I pay more attention to?
Yeah. Why don't I speak up?
Yeah. And why don't I listen to my body and just make a little different move here? It doesn't always even have to be words. And so there's that curiosity, grabbing a hold of a little bit of curiosity is a super good antidote, I think, to losing autonomy.
That's it for this week. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Sexual Mindfulness Project, and subscribe to our website, shalomlevitt.com, to stay up to date with the latest information on sexual mindfulness. Thanks for listening.